The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Shell and today's episode will make you hungry. A little later on in the show, we'll be talking to science columnist Tora Katcher about the technologies that are being developed to feed a demanding and expanding world. But let's start with the fundamentals. Why food tastes so good in the first place, and the science of making it taste even better. My first guest today is Guy Crosby, the science editor for America's Test Kitchen. He's also an adjunct associate professor in the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health and an external advisor for the first-of-its-kind eco-gastronomy program at the University of New Hampshire. Guy has published 42 scientific papers, is the inventor of 17 U.S. patents, and on April 1, 2013, he was officially included in the first group of certified food scientists approved by the Institute of Food Technologists. He's the co-author of a new book, The Science of Good Cooking. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Guy.
Oh, it's great to be here, and especially to talk about our new book.
So can you tell us a little bit about how the book came into being?
If you're familiar with America's Test Kitchen and their magazines, especially Cooks Illustrated, you know they take a fairly scientific approach to recipe development so they can understand exactly what's going on as they're preparing a food, cooking a food, with the objective that they really would like to make their recipes, you know, bulletproof, that they will work repeatedly for many different types of people, cooking them under different conditions. So understanding the science is quite important, and they've been putting that emphasis and have little science sidebars and quite a bit of science built into their recipe stories for many years now. So it just seemed logical that, ultimately if somebody was going to come out with a really thoroughly developed cooking science book, that it would be America's Test Kitchen. And I know I started talking to them about it a number of years ago. And of course they said, yes, well, we've been thinking about that, but we just can't quite figure out the right format and what would be most appealing and so on and so forth. So ultimately, I think it was in August 2010, I got together with Jack Bishop, who's their executive editor, number two in command there. And we worked out a contract to go ahead and write the book, since I work with them as an independent contractor, as science editor. So we had a contract and we started working in August 2010. And so it's been, you know, quite a process. It's taken us 2 years to finally get it ready and publish. It was published last October in 2012. But it just seemed like a very, very logical thing to do. And I think we've gotten very good feedback from our readers, as well as other people, you know, that they enjoy the book and they find it very helpful. And, you know, I would say Jack Bishop, again, he designed the format of the book, so he gets a lot of credit for creating something that has been very appealing for people.
You mentioned format, and that I love how this book is laid out, because although every cookbook could be described as an instruction manual of some kind, you guys have really taken it a step farther, because you've written about scientific concepts as they relate to cooking. So maybe talk a bit about the format and why you chose to lay it out that way, or why he did.
So, of course, there's the usual kind of many sections on general introductory topics, like about heat and utensils and measuring things and so on. But what it really comes down to, the bulk of it is centered around 50 different cooking concepts. So, you know, rather than say, let's design a book that has divided into meats and vegetables and so on types of food, which many books are, this was based around different cooking concepts. And ultimately, after going through and developing a number of concepts, and we sort of kept adding to the list, 50 seemed to be the right number. In fact, for a little while, we were stuck at 49 and we said, no, we've got to have 50. So we had 50 concepts, and each concept is developed. So each kind of what you might say chapter is a concept. Each concept starts out with a full-page description and sometimes a little more than one page of the science around that particular concept. For example, around brining meat or on whipping egg whites, various things of that sort. We start with the science, and then the next page for every single concept is a test kitchen experiment where we actually developed experiments that illustrate the science from a cooking perspective. And this probably was one of the more difficult things to do, was to come up with meaningful test kitchen experiments that would illustrate the science and yet be very simple, very practical. You know, and this was done, all of these were worked on and developed in collaboration with Dan Souza, who's one of the really outstanding test cooks at America's Test Kitchen. So he did all these. In fact, his picture is right there in the front of the book. So we follow the scientific principles with the test kitchen experiment that illustrates it, and then we follow with recipes. And then in almost every case, each recipe, we explain why the recipe works in terms of the science that was developed around that concept. So people have an understanding in pretty good detail about why certain things were done, why some things work, some things don't work, things to do, things to avoid. And then scattered throughout every single concept, we have a number of little practical science sidebars, you know, just looking at very specific issues. We have over 150 of them. So there's lots of little practical science sidebars that kind of take you aside and say, now, look, here's an important point you need to know about this particular recipe or this science concept, and go into it in a little bit more detail.
You start out the book talking about the different kinds of heat that we use to cook food. So maybe let's break that down a bit.
In that section, and that's one of my topics I really do enjoy talking about, but in that section, we're mostly focusing on, since it's an introduction, it's kind of a general practice discussion about temperature and about ways of measuring it, and how measuring temperature is much more accurate way of cooking than just doing it by vision or feel. So we do talk about, you know, the importance of temperature, how each person's oven, you know, we did mentions in the book that they gave very accurate thermometers to 15 of the test cooks to take home and measure the temperature of their ovens, and, you know, set at 350 degrees. And the actual temperatures of the ovens varied from 300 to 390 degrees. So, you know, it shows you what kind of variation people are dealing with, even when they can measure the temperature. But it's very important to measure the temperature either with a thermometer or one of these instant read that you can insert into a food and tell the temperature. You know, we get into it from a practical way, but what I like very much that keeps popping up every now and then when I talk to, we go over some of the science, for example, on the TV with the founder, Chris Kimball, who hosts the show, and that is the difference between temperature and heat, and they're not the same. I mean, a lot of people think, well, temperature is just measuring heat, and heat is a form of energy, but they actually are quite different. And the example that I like to use that we developed and published in one of the Cook's Illustrated magazines is the difference in temperature and heat when you're looking at two different substances that you might normally cook with, for example, olive oil and water, or let's use actually probably wine as the more practical example, but water versus olive oil. So if you take, let's say, a cup of each and start each one out at room temperature and heat each one up so that they are both ultimately brought up to 165 degrees Fahrenheit, which would be 74 degrees centigrade. So they're brought up to the same temperature. It actually takes more than twice as much energy in the form of heat to bring water up to that temperature of 165 degrees than it does to bring the olive oil up to the same temperature. So we had a little experiment we did because one of the senior editors there just really doubted. He says, well, olive oil is hotter than water. And of course, he's thinking the fact that you can heat oil up much hotter than water, because water boils at 212 degrees, so it won't go any higher. But olive oil, for example, other oils can keep on going much higher than that. So he always thought, well, olive oil is hotter than water. It's going to cook faster and so on. But we had him stick his fingers in these two cups. Now, his were only heated to like 140 degrees. And he instantly noticed how hot the water was versus the olive oil, which didn't feel nearly as hot. And then the other thing we did was we took two pans where we heated them up. In this case, it was to 165 degrees Fahrenheit, dropped an egg in each one. And in the olive oil, the egg remained fairly transparent. You know, you could see it. It doesn't look like the protein had coagulated. In the one with water, the proteins were clearly starting to turn white and coagulate in that same amount of time. So you notice that there is a lot more energy in the form of heat in water than there is in, say, olive oil at the same temperature. So this illustrates the difference between heat and temperature. You can have something, two substances at the same temperature, but they most likely will contain different amounts of heat. And that heat is called heat capacity of a substance. And if you want, we can go into why water takes more energy to heat it up to the same temperature than oil, if you want to go into that, or we can go on to something else.
Oh, no, I would like to hear that, please.
Okay, well, so water molecules have a very strong affinity for each other. It's a thing we call hydrogen bonding, where the hydrogen atoms are attracted to the one molecule, to the oxygen atoms of another. And so they have an affinity for each other. They want to stick to each other. They're kind of sticky. Whereas fat molecules, you know, they don't really interact with each other all that strongly, much less so than water. And so if we're measuring the temperature of something, that's really comes down to measuring how fast the molecules are moving around. As we raise the temperature, the molecules start moving faster and faster. If you're going to pull the water molecules away from each other so they can start to speed up and move faster, that takes a lot more energy to pull them apart than it does to pull fat molecules apart. So you've got to put more energy into all the water molecules to get them to separate so they can speed faster at the same temperature that olive oil would. All right. So it just is a matter of kind of putting in that energy to get the molecules separated so they can move around faster and faster as the temperature goes up.
I love this book.
Well, that's great to hear.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and I'm joined by Guy Crosby, the science editor for America's Test Kitchen and co-author of the book, The Science of Good Cooking. Now, I really like the section about resting meat because I knew that we should let roasts rest before cutting them, but I did not know why. Can you explain that?
It's interesting that when you cook meat of any real kind, because whether you're talking about chicken or pork or beef, the proteins, the muscle proteins, are all pretty much made out of the same things. And they have essentially the same overall structure. And as you heat a piece of meat, the proteins, once you get to a certain temperature, usually above 140 degrees Fahrenheit, the proteins will start to, these are linear proteins, they're sort of stretched out for the most part. And they will start to shrink and pull together. And when they do, the water, which is inside these muscle fibers, so muscle fibers are made of various different structures. And when you get down to finer and finer details in the structure, most of the water is inside the various things we call microfibrils in the meat. And so as the fibers shrink, they start to squeeze the water out. And so you find that, you know, again, all those different types of meat all contain around 75% water in their raw state. So there's a lot of water in there. And as the muscle fibers heat up and they shrink, just like, you know, you can stretch a rubber band and then let it go and it shrinks back again, the water gets squeezed out from in and around the muscle fibers. And so the amount of water that is squeezed out is directly related to the temperature that you heat the meat. If you heat it to 140 degrees, the muscle fibers will have shrunk a certain amount, and less than if you heated it to 160 degrees. And the amount of water that is expressed or expelled from the fibers near the inside of the meat is proportional to that temperature. What resting the meat does, it allows the meat to cool a little. It allows the fibers to begin to relax again and absorb some of that moisture that had been squeezed out back inside the fibers where they were located. So that's the reason why it's so very important to allow meat to rest, so you can reabsorb some, by no means all, of that moisture. So we've done a little bit of work, and we find that you probably want to let meat rest until it's around 120 degrees Fahrenheit inside in order to get as much of that moisture absorbed back in as is possible.
Is there an upper limit, I guess, on how long a roast should rest, before the resting starts actually working against you?
Well, it will depend on the size of the meat. You know, so if you have a steak, which is not an awfully big piece of meat, you might want to rest it 15 minutes. If you've got a roast that's much larger, you know, weighs a lot more, so that it's going to take longer for that internal temperature to cool back down and the muscles to relax, you probably want to rest it for 20 to 30 minutes. You know, if you're talking about a 3 or 4 or 5 pound roast.
And maybe I should say it, because hot food does keep on cooking.
Oh, it does. Right. So this is carryover cooking. That's another concept that's in there, that if you take out anything that you're cooking, but especially something large like a roast turkey or chicken or roasted, you know, pork, beef, and you've heated it up to a certain temperature inside, as you take it out, the outside, of course, is much hotter than the inside, and the heat from the outside is going to continue to move into the inner portion of that meat, and it'll continue to cook it. So you really want to take meat out a little, I would say everything but turkey and chicken, you want to take it out a little before the temperature that you think you would finally like to have it cooked to. And so where pork and beef, it's very important in terms of tenderness that you don't want to overcook it. You want to take it out when it's probably 5 or 10 degrees cooler than when you would like to, because it's going to keep on heating up and up, and and the fibers will shrink more, and that squeezes out more moisture. That makes the meat tougher. Chicken and turkey is different because you've got to make sure that you can get the you do get the temperature up to a minimum of 160 degrees in all parts of the turkey or chicken, because in their case, the risk is salmonella, bacteria poisoning, and that can actually be inside the tissue of the meat, anywhere within the chicken or turkey. So you've got to make sure it's completely heated to that temperature to kill all the bacteria that might possibly be in there. Whereas if you have a big piece of pork or beef, especially beef, I'm familiar with this, the inside is sterile. The contamination is only on the outside that generally comes from the processing of the meat. So you can cook a piece of beef till it's quite rare, 110, 120 degrees, and it's still safe to eat as long as the outside got over 160 degrees. Whereas chicken and turkey, you've got to heat everywhere throughout the whole piece of poultry to 160 degrees to make sure it's completely safe to eat. So those are some of the different temperatures that you want and reasons why, you know, you can heat some higher or you need to heat some higher than others. Maybe I get off a little bit of a tangent here, but
that's pretty much the name of this show.
Okay.
You have settled the ongoing debate about the best way to lay a barbecue fire, the best way to lay the coals.
There are a number of different ways, but generally several things that we do, and that is to first start hot coals on one side of a grill, and then you put some unlit coals on top of that so that they will warm up and continue to burn, and it'll last if you need to use that grill for an hour or 2 hours. You know, you want to have it structured in a way that they'll last during that whole period of time. And we do that so that you typically have the coals on one side so that you can put something like a piece of meat directly over the begin to dry out the surface and start to brown the surface and get all those flavors developed on the surface, and then move it to the cooler side to finish cooking more slowly so that you don't overheat the surface or the part of the meat that's close to the outside so it doesn't get excessively dry, doesn't shrink, doesn't get tough. And what we also do is we put an aluminum pan with water inside the grill, you know, underneath the grating, in this area where the coals are not piled up on the other side. And what we've done a number of tests, and we find that, you know, both with no pan, with just an aluminum pan, with an aluminum pan with water, that the aluminum pan will, just the aluminum itself, will lower the temperature inside the grill about 30 degrees. If you add water to the pan, it'll lower it by maybe another 10 degrees because they're additive. But the other thing that it does is it evens out the temperature. We've done through different thermal couples all around the grill, and normally without any pan in there, you can have quite different temperatures in different regions of the grill. But if you put an aluminum pan in there, you'll find that the temperatures, because a lot of that heat's getting absorbed and then redistributed by the aluminum pan, with or without water, that the temperature in the grill is even, more evenly controlled inside the grill. So those are the major elements, is, you know, is putting the coals on one side, adding some unlit coals on top so that they will light and continue to burn long enough if you're cooking something fairly slow, putting in an aluminum pan with some water in it on the unlit side underneath the grating to keep the temperature down from getting too hot, but to also, more importantly, to keep it evenly distributed.
And we'll be back with more of Guy Crosby and his book, The Science of Good Cooking, here on Skeptically Speaking after these messages.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, here with Guy Crosby, the science editor for America's Test Kitchen, adjunct associate professor in the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health, and co-author of a new book, The Science of Good Cooking. Now, I don't want people to think that the book only deals with meat. So let's talk a bit about vegetables. Now, the biggest danger with cooking vegetables is that they often end up soggy and that they lose some of their color. So how do we avoid that? Well, first of all, why do those things happen and how do we avoid that?
Well, you know, because you're talking about different colors and different kinds of vegetables. And, you know, I will say, right, there's maybe 25% of the recipes, most are related to meat, but there's a lot on vegetables and all other kinds of foods, especially legumes. In the color, you know, if we're talking about green vegetables, then chlorophyll is the green color. Several things will affect the color, but if you make the cooking water a little acidic, that acid tends to take the chlorophyll molecule, which contains a magnesium atom at its core, and pulls that magnesium atom out of there. So that ends up producing a new green color, which is kind of like olive green, and that's why it tends to go very dull. And a lot of vegetables, as they cook, will, and the pectin breaks down. The pectin is the polysaccharide that, you know, holds all the cells together as part of the cell walls, and it breaks down to galacturonic acid. So the pH will tend to drop a little bit, and the magnesium, the chlorophyll is not that stable. You can lose some of the magnesium atoms, and so the color starts to become olive and drab when you overcook it. There are ways that you can correct that. One of them is just simply adding a little salt can tend to stabilize the chlorophyll molecule a little bit, but even just a tiny, tiny pinch of baking soda will help to neutralize any acid that might be released from the vegetables as they cook, and that will actually help to enhance the green color from chlorophyll. The other thing that affects color is when you put in many different types, especially leafy vegetables, and you begin to start to actually brighten the color in the first few minutes. So you blanch vegetables, for example, very briefly. It means heating just very quickly in boiling water for maybe a minute or less. And what happens, that gets some of the air out of the cells, and that makes the light refracted more directly. So you can actually get an enhancement, an intensity of the green color in vegetables when you just blanch them very quickly and help get some of the air bubbles out of the cell that otherwise tend to, you know, bend the light more and make it a little bit more opaque and kind of reduce the brightness of the green color. So various things that you can do, you know, adding a little salt or better yet, even a pinch of baking soda or blanching vegetables, making sure things don't, you know, you don't add any acid to the water when you're cooking it. Those are the things that you can do to control some of the colors in vegetables.
Since you mentioned salt, salt also helps to draw flavor compounds out, and this is shown by studies.
It's true, it does, and I don't think people who maybe are trying to control their level of salt should be overly alarmed. For example, if you take tomato, is probably a very good example, but we've done it with other vegetables as well. The one of the valuable things about tomatoes is the lycopene content. That's pigment that creates most of the red color in tomatoes. And in tomatoes, this lycopene, which is a carotenoid, it's a very hydrophobic, fat-loving molecule, tends to be bound up with proteins within the cell wall components of the tomatoes. So if you eat a raw tomato, you will only be able to absorb a certain amount of lycopene into your blood. If you chop the tomato and then salt it with, and this is for a large amount of tomatoes, you only need like a half a teaspoon. So it's a very small amount. I forget, I had calculated how much salt that is, but it's very, very small amount of salt. The ionic salt, sodium chloride, helps to break up some of these complexes of the lycopene with various proteins in the cell wall components and free up and liberate more of that lycopene in the color. And you're doing the same thing with the flavor molecules. I'm just using lycopene as an obvious example, but the flavor molecules are the same way. Most of them are actually breakdown products of the carotenoids, oxidation products, so that they're fairly hydrophobic. They tend to bind to the cell wall materials, to proteins. So a little bit of salt will not only liberate some more lycopene, but it'll liberate more of these flavor molecules so you can enhance the flavor. And of course, if you take tomatoes and cook them, then you really break down the cell walls and you liberate lots of lycopene and other flavor molecules. Why cooked tomato products can taste much more flavorful than even the simple raw tomato. And it's been shown, for example, that you absorb about 4 times more lycopene into your blood if you eat cooked tomato products than if you eat raw tomatoes. So it's freeing up these fat-loving, hydrophobic flavor and pigment molecules, either by cooking and or by adding a little salt to them.
Well, and those flavor molecules are affected by the tools you use as well, and the way you use those tools. You wrote an entire section on how slicing changes garlic and onion flavor.
Garlic and onion are examples where the flavor molecules themselves do not exist in the whole garlic or whole head of onion. You know, if you pick up an onion that's fairly fresh and smell it, you really won't smell any onion flavor. Pick up a whole clove of garlic that's still in the skin, smell it, or a head of garlic better, so you don't do anything to tamper with it. You won't smell any garlic. What happens is when you chop them, you damage the cells, and within each cell there are compounds, sulfur-containing compounds in the case of garlic and onion, that get exposed to a specific enzyme called alanase, which then cause very, very, very rapidly the formation of these intense aromatic molecules that you then smell as raw garlic or as raw onion. So it comes about only when you damage the cells. So the more you damage the cells, for example, if you just slice it, you'll only liberate, you know, damage so many cells, versus if you literally put it in a garlic press and pulverize all the cells, you're going to release many, many more of these flavor molecules that will be formed and released than if you just gently slice it. So how much you slice it or how finely you slice it makes a big difference. Whether you let it rest a little bit, a few minutes, so that there's time for this chemistry to kind of catch up and take place, will intensify the garlic. And then, of course, when you cook it, these molecules get changed to other molecules, other sulfur molecules that are more mellow tasting, so that you reduce some of the harsh taste of the raw onion and raw garlic. And where this same concept is very, very important are all these, actually most vegetables, the majority of vegetables, especially the cruciferous vegetables, you know, like cabbage and Brussels sprouts and broccoli, and even members of this family like horseradish and arugula, kale. I mean, there's so many of them. There are almost 40 of these vegetables that we typically eat. The same thing goes on. You do not create the characteristic flavor of any of these vegetables until you actually damage the cells. And then you get compounds that are released, come in contact with an enzyme, in this case it's called myrosinase, and form these new flavor molecules. So how you chop, cut, prepare vegetables is very important, just as important as how you cut and chop garlic and onion. In fact, the most common vegetables where this is not the case, where the flavors are already exist in the vegetable, and so they don't depend on how much you chop them or cut them, are things like, let's see, asparagus and green bell peppers and celery and carrots. But most of the other vegetables, you don't form those flavors until you actually start to chop up the cut, slice the vegetable, and damage the cells, and then the flavors are created. Also to consider is that, you know, a lot of these cruciferous vegetables that I've just mentioned can be fairly bitter. And you find it's very difficult, even though they're extremely healthy, to get children to learn to like them, because children are very sensitive to bitter taste. But because a lot of the bitter compounds are formed by this enzyme reaction when you're preparing the vegetables, you can reduce the bitterness quite significantly in these types of vegetables by blanching them. And that is, again, putting them in boiling water for 30 seconds to 1 minute. And that's enough heat to deactivate the enzyme. So then you take them out, run them into cold water, and then you can finish cooking them, sauteing them, putting them in whatever you want. You'll still have a lot of flavor, but you'll find that the bitterness is reduced quite significantly. So, you know, that's one way of trying to get children to learn to like these vegetables, by just reducing their bitterness.
Okay, so let's throw some science at a few common food debates that you have tried to resolve in your test kitchen. Farmed salmon versus wild salmon, that's a big one. So is there a difference in taste?
You know, a lot of the taste in salmon has to do with the fat in salmon. And salmon, of course, is very, very high in polyunsaturated fats. And so that's one of the reasons that can create some difference in the overall flavor of farmed versus wild salmon is the fat level. And for a number of years, I would read that people would say, oh, farmed salmon isn't any good because it doesn't contain nearly as many of these essential or these important polyunsaturated fatty acids is wild salmon. And that is not correct. It all depends on what feed is given to the salmon that's being farmed. And it's in the best interest of the people farming salmon, because that's why a lot of people will eat salmon, for example, is because of the very, very healthful polyunsaturated fatty acids, so that they will give them a diet that's high in these polyunsaturated fatty acids, soy meal and other things. So the USDA, you can go on their websites. They maintain it, although it's fish is really under the guidance of the FDA. But the USDA will maintain a website. You can go in where they periodically test and publish the data, and you can see that the fatty acid content of farm salmon can be anywhere equal to wild salmon and twice as much. So you can actually have farmed salmon that have twice as much overall polyunsaturated fat, and because that's going to lead to a lot of the flavor of salmon when you cook it. Sometimes maybe more intense than people would like, but you know, there is a difference, largely because of not only a species difference between farmed and wild salmon, but especially in the fat content and the actual nature and composition and makeup of the fat in the farmed versus wild salmon.
Okay, next. Does searing seal in the juices? Because I have been told that my entire life.
Right. Well, that's been around for a very long time, ever since a German chemist, von Liebig, published this and said, well, you know, if you want to keep the juices in, you just have to sear the meat. And this was back in the 1800s. So that one has stuck with us for a very, very, very long time. We and others have published some studies that show, you know, searing does not seal in the juices. It's not like you're creating some plastic coating on the fish that won't allow the juices to escape. And in fact, most of the juice that we're really talking about is the juice that is squeezed out of the inside of the muscle fibers to the inside of the meat, to the free space within the meat. And of course, when we talked about resting meat, how important it was, if you take a steak that you've cooked and, you know, a lot of this moisture gets squeezed out of the muscle fibers to the inner parts of the meat and you slice that right away, you'll see a lot of juice running right out of it. And that's the most important juice that we're talking about, is when you slice it, it's all going to come from the outside. So, you know, even if you did sear the meat enough to seal in the juices, which doesn't happen, it's the juice that's freed up that's inside the meat that then escapes and runs out as soon as you slice the meat. That's really the critical thing.
So is there any benefit to searing then?
Oh, searing, you know, creates tons and tons and tons of flavor. So we sear things to create flavor through this Maillard reaction, which is the reaction of amino acids from the breakdown of protein when you cook the meat, reacting with small amounts of sugars that are in the meat, mostly glucose. It's there as, you know, as a major source of energy for any kind of living animal, and it remains in the meat. So the sugars like glucose react with the amino acids and form these reaction products that are very important contributors to the flavor of anything that is browned, that is roasted. You know, we find it when you sear a piece of meat, or when you bake a loaf of bread on the outside, when you roast coffee beans, when you roast chocolate beans. All of these things create these Maillard reaction products, reaction of amino acids with sugars. And they're extremely intense. There's many hundreds of them are created, but they're very intense. And we can detect many of these in the order of parts per million all the way down to a part per trillion. And so you need very little of these being formed, but they create the real important attributes of the flavor of things that are heated to fairly high temperatures. And the other point is, if you have a piece of meat where you want to sear it and develop a lot of these flavors, you want to have the surface as dry as possible, whether you're going to roast it in the oven or out on a grill, because as long as that surface is really moist, the surface will never go above the boiling point of water. And until the water evaporates from the surface, only then can the temperature go up to get to about 300 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, which is what you need in order to have this Maillard reaction product really take off and occur fast enough that, you know, just brief cooking periods will create lots and lots of flavor. So we always say the more browning, the more flavor, whenever you're cooking a piece of meat or anything where you're actually browning it. And because that one last point on this, that brings up a point I guess we try to clarify, is that a lot of chefs will use the term caramelization when they're searing or browning a piece of meat. They'll say, well, I'm caramelizing the meat. Well, caramelization refers only to reactions of sugars. So when you take sucrose, table sugar, and you heat it up and it gets nice and caramely and brown, that's caramelization. It's a reaction of one sugar molecule with another. In meat, browning is due to the Maillard reaction because you've got tons of protein and amino acids and only a small amount of sugar that's present. So most of the browning is all due to the Maillard reaction. So it really is not appropriate to say you're caramelizing a piece of meat when the vast majority of the browning that you're doing is coming from the Maillard reaction rather than from caramelization of sugars.
Okay, now this one very much shocked me. Aluminum foil, shiny side out or shiny side in?
I think it makes no difference. It goes way, way, way back, but I can't remember that it makes a difference. But
no, they lied. I was told in home economics class when I was very young that it did indeed matter.
I know we've got it. I think it's in the book, but and this is one little minor detail that I have forgotten. Do you have the answer?
I do have the answer. It does
what
not
does it
matter
say?
One whit.
Oh, good.
Not
I was right then. Okay, that's what I remembered. Good. Okay.
I needed to get that out to the audience.
There's so many facts in this book. Unfortunately, I can't recall all of them because I finished writing it. When did we finish writing it? In March, it went to all the test proof, March of 2012. So it's been that long since I've really dug into this book. And
well, it is chock full of debunking of different food myths, which I love. Because these are things that we take for granted, and they've been passed on through generations, and it looks like some of them aren't worth the paper they're printed on. So that's actually another one. Flambé. I always assumed that that was just performance art, honestly, but it turns out that it does affect the flavor of the food.
Well, it certainly can because you know when you flambéing something or whether you're making a wine sauce or whatever, you don't remove all of the alcohol, and flambéing is such a short process that the one study that's been done shows that a fair amount of alcohol can actually remain in the food that you're flambéing. So it can contribute some flavor. Plus, it can certainly help to, catalyze or undergo reactions with some of the molecules, the alcohol, and create some new flavors. You know, you can take acids and esterify them with the alcohol and create some new flavors. So there's a whole host of things that can happen when you are adding that instantaneous burst of heat in something that's got a fair amount of alcohol in it. So it does contribute to the flavor.
But also performance art.
Oh, definitely. It looks good. It's very showy. Yes.
So are there any other food myths that you'd like to sort out before we sign off?
There's a fair number of them. And in fact, I just heard one of the top chefs, a judge on this cooking show a few weeks ago saying, he was cooking a big pot of water, you know, to cook pasta. And the poor contestant threw in a little salt at the very end. And the test cook exclaimed, oh, why didn't he put that salt in at the beginning? Because it would raise the boiling point of water, the temperature of the water, and the pasta would cook faster. Well, you know, he threw in a little pinch of salt, and a little pinch of salt is not going to make a single dent in the boiling temperature of water. You've got to throw in a whole bunch of salt before you can really raise the boiling point of water to any significant degree that you would affect the cooking rate of a food. So that's one, you know, that a little tiny bit of salt is going to actually raise the boiling point or the cooking temperature of water and make things cook faster. That it just doesn't happen. One that I like very much is that it's been around for a long time that if you cook something frying in oil at a much lower temperature than say you might normally fry something in oil, that it's going to absorb a lot more of the oil. And that's not true. We've shown that very clearly in our easy French fry recipe, where we had a recipe where you take the raw potatoes, put them in oil at room temperature and heat it up until the fries are just done. And it takes about 25 minutes. The temperature never gets above 200 and 285 degrees Fahrenheit versus where you might normally fry things around 350 Fahrenheit. And we sent these fries out to a laboratory and they actually contain 30% less fat than the ones cooked by the classical method, which we did side by side where you fry them at a higher temperature. So that's another one. You know, things about marinades, adding flavor to meat really doesn't do much of anything. The only thing that really impacts in a marinade is if you use a salty marinade, the salt will penetrate the meat and will help to tenderize the meat and will help to hold moisture in the meat. But acidic marinades don't do very much of anything other than on the very surface of the meat. And any of the fat-soluble seasonings that you might put in it aren't going to penetrate in the meat either, because the meat is about 75% water. So
You know, you're destroying people's worldviews right now.
All these different things. Well, of course, a lot of it's in the book. Not all of these things, but a lot of people think that if you're braising meat, which is to cooking it in a certain amount of liquid, that meat will turn out to be moister than if you cook the meat with dry heat. And that doesn't turn out to be the case at all. You know, whether you cook it in liquid or whether you cook it with dry heat, the amount of moisture that's going to remain in the piece of meat is directly related to the temperature at which the meat rises to inside the meat. So if you cooked meat to the same temperature inside, whether you cook it in a whole bunch of water or you cook it in an oven, it's going to end up with the same amount of moisture inside, which is directly related to the temperature of the meat and has nothing to do with whether you cook it in liquid or cook it dry.
Do you consider the book then sort of a novel way to talk about science or about cooking, or do you think that understanding sort of the chemical interactions and such and the biology of food is more of an integral part of becoming a good cook?
Knowing a little bit about the science, and we don't go into the science in any great depth or complexity, but knowing something about it and why certain things happen is helpful in terms of just, you know, it's like if you know how your car works, you probably tend to understand it and can deal with the mechanic and have it fixed and even fix some of it yourself a little better than if you knew absolutely nothing about how it works. So I think the science is important. I think one of the things that's really important, and we're finding more and more of this is the case, is that it's a wonderful way of teaching science to young people who love food, and a lot of them are interested in cooking, or at least they can easily relate to cooking because they see their parents and maybe they get involved in it all the time. And I think they can understand and accept and find a lot more enjoyment in the science when they relate it to something like food and cooking. So we've found a lot of teachers who are wanting to use the science in this book for teaching science to their children in school. I was fascinated once when I went to visit a friend in California, and she said, I have to have this young man come over. He's a neighbor and he wants to talk to you. He bought your book. He's only 12 years old. And he sat there and he talked to me for a whole hour asking me about all the questions about different aspects of the science in the book. And then he said, I'm going to go home right now and I'm going to cook such and such kind of cookies and see if this really works the way you told me, and so on. So yeah, it's a good way for children to learn science. And I think it's a good way for adults just to understand better what they're doing when they're cooking.
Guy, great to have you here.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to talk to you about the book, and I'm so glad you like it, and I hope it continues to do well.
Me too. You can find links to Guy Crosby and his book, The Science of Good Cooking, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be back to talk about the future of food with science columnist Tora Katcher after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're skipping to the tail end of the digestive tract to learn some fascinating facts about feces. Rochelle Saunders welcomes science journalist Maren McKenna back to the show to discuss human gut bacteria and the biome-boosting power of fecal transplants. Desiree Schell speaks to anthropologist Cecil Lewis about what studying ancient poo can tell us about the evolution of the human microbiome. And Rochelle speaks to zoologist Eric Warrant about how some species of dung beetles can navigate by the light of the Milky Way. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm joined now by Tora Katcher. As a national science columnist for CBC Radio, Tora gets to share her passion for science each and every week, with topics ranging as far as male testicle size to how snowflakes form. Her science knowledge is diverse and extensive. After completing a PhD from the University of Alberta, she became an expert in worm gonads, and she realizes that this makes it awkward to talk to her about it. Thanks for being here, Tora.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So I wanted to talk to you about the future of food, and you've been keeping track of all the new developments in this area. So what does the future have in store for us?
I've been keeping track, and the future doesn't look very good right now.
Great. Good.
If we keep on the track that we're going, we will run out. I mean, not to mention that it's such an imbalance of where the food, the safety and security issues are. We have way too much in the Western world, and we have nowhere near enough in the poor areas of the world. But if the UN estimates estimates that our population is going to be at 9 billion people in the next, well, at 27 or 37 years. So we're going to be huge. And if we want to feed all of those people in just even in the next 40 or so years, with the plans that we've got and with the technology and traditional way of farming that we have, we need to find 3 land masses the size of Russia that are fertile in order to grow enough food. It's not very good. I don't think there's any three Russias hiding around anywhere. So it's not very good. And so we have to figure out a better way. And there's all sorts of different, you know, scientific strategies and scientific inventions that will help us feed the planet, which we're just not going to be able to do. So
you are just a ray of sunshine, you know.
But there, you know what? We can rely on science to rescue us. That's what we're just going to have to do.
Sing it, sister. What do we got? Yeah. What is going to save us from ourselves?
Yes. Well, we're going to have to find some new things to eat. We're going to have to find some things that we don't normally eat, and we're going to have to like them. Those things include insects. There's a lot of areas of the world. I know there's a lot of people out there who eat insects on a regular basis, and us on our, you know, meat and potatoes kind of diet aren't used to that. But insects are an incredible source of food and source of nutrition. There's 370 different genera of insects that are consumed. They're incredibly high in iron. They're low in fat. They're very high in protein. They're way better for you, and they're not going to cause heart disease like beef does. They can be, depending on the type, you've got to learn whether to eat them at the larval stages or the adult stages. But you can eat crickets. You can eat all sorts of different beetles. You can eat, of course, ants. I've had ants before in the Amazon. They were live, so they started to crawl around my mouth a little bit. But they're pretty good. We also have to eat algae. Algae is an excellent source. We eat them, of course. We eat nori, which is a type of red algae that we use in our sushi. So most people have had a little bit of algae before, but we're talking much larger scale. It's salty. It has a weird texture, but algae grows in really unhealthy waters, I guess, because we're also poisoning our oceans. So that fish stocks are declining, but the algae can grow in that. So we can grow them in low quality water at high yield. Again, very high in iron, very high in all sorts of different nutrients, low fat, and also very, very cheap. So it's just a matter of adjusting our palate to a certain extent so that we can accommodate these new foods just because we have to.
Well, is that really the problem? Is it just the fact that it's unpalatable to us because that's not a part of our background? Or are there other challenges involved?
Really, at this point, with particularly the insects and these alternative food sources, it's really just palate. It's really just getting used to it. People all around the world have deep fried crickets, and there's actually pretty good cricket chocolate chip cookie recipe online. It's actually pretty good.
We may actually link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, no, it's worth trying because you don't. It just tastes like nothing. It tastes like chocolate chip cookies. Like, you know, put enough chocolate chips and everything tastes good. But then there's, you know, then let's, okay, that's just switching our current food sources. But we probably are going to have to look beyond that as well. And there's everyone probably heard about the schmeat that was served in August. That was an artificial or lab-grown meat. So it was grown from stem cells. And that was funded, actually, it was revealed when it was served in London, that it has all been funded by the Google founder, Sergey Brin. And he's funded the stem cell researcher in the Netherlands, Mark Post, who is layering stem cells that have been turned into muscle cells. And these are from a cow. So it really is beef. And layering, and you sort of, with stem cells, they have the potential to grow into any kind of cell type in the body. And you sort of manipulated them and coaxed them with different chemical formula to get them to produce muscle cells. They grow in sheets, which is why they're calling it schmeat, because it's sheet meat. Talk about unpalatable. Like, let's pick another name. And they grew it into a 5-ounce patty. It took years. And served it as a ground beef patty. And now it costs like $400,000 Canadian dollars to do that one 5-ounce patty. So it's more about upscaling this it's not artificial meat. It's real cells. It's real meat. Right. But it's just made in a very artificial setting in the lab. There's no animals that have to be killed. So it's very ethical. You can manipulate it so that it has, for instance, omega-3 fatty acids, different nutritional profiles, so it's healthy for you. So it's a really interesting option. And there's a couple people out there, you know, future casters, let's just say this is maybe an area of skepticism, who think that you might one day have like a size of a boat of a bar fridge, which is your meat incubator, which you grow your own meat.
Tora, I cannot explain how much I want this technology.
This is a schmeat brilliant. Oven. You have a meat garden.
But I personally would like to pick like steaks off a plant. I'm hoping they develop something like that. But the problem with this, weren't they having a problem with texture?
They were having a problem with texture. It sort of had this sort of slimy texture like a scallop. Now, my understanding from the reports, I wasn't invited to the schmeat tasting, but it was that it actually, they've resolved that. They've changed the sort of fat lipid profile that they're growing them in. And so it's not as slimy as it originally was thought to be. So
that still doesn't sound terribly appetizing.
Not entirely. But I mean, again, there is huge advantages in nutrition and environmental as well, because we've got our current methods of farming animals, which is a huge contributor to greenhouse gases because of the burps and the gaseous just exhalations from our livestock is a huge producer of methane. And that's a very potent greenhouse gas, much more powerful than carbon dioxide. So there's another added benefit to schmeat, and at this point, it was just a now figuring out how do we make it so that it's inexpensive or at least accessible to anyone in the public.
Okay, what else we got?
We've got vertical farms. These are interesting. These are like skyscraper farms. And so what happens with these, and this idea is sort of originated, and they're building one in New York. They've got a couple sort of in the works in Vancouver. And these vertical farms are literally everything that you need to everything that we farm on different floors of a skyscraper. So you have your wheat, you have your fish, you have all sorts of different things. Every single crop and every single farm and everything that we do for traditional agriculture. So vertical farms is a very interesting strategy. The thing with it is that it's very self-contained, and we're calling it hyper-local because you're literally going to buy the food that's produced on the building above it. So it's not just buying local to the local farms. Your farm is your neighbor. And it's very efficient because things like gray water from the fishery that's upstairs goes downstairs to water the gardens. And they're talking about having – Japanese have done this, actually, with a fiber optic cable that brings in the sunlight into the basement where their Japanese are doing it. So that technology was developed there. Or having a bunch of mirror reflectors so that you can always have sufficient sunlight without having to run the high energy, high watt bulbs that you would have in a traditional greenhouse. So it's, again, becoming closer to carbon neutral than our current food sources, closer to energy efficient. And so that the vertical farms are certainly happening, and they're, again, just really an incredible opportunity to prevent biodegradation issues, to prevent all of our soil degradation and our biodiversity issues that we have with our current crops. Is that we can leave the world to the wilderness and have all of our farming done in the skyscraper. So we'll see where that goes.
Well, so why aren't we seeing those everywhere? Because that sounds brilliant.
Money more than anything, right? I mean, really, it comes down to it's having the vision and having the investment to put it in. There's certain issues where with air filtration systems that have to come in. They're talking about using termite mounds as inspiration for air circulation to get rid of all the noxious gases that some things are releasing, like the livestock, and also having enough oxygen for the plants to grow at high levels. So those kinds of things, these termite mounds have these incredible wind tunnels. They're looking at trying to navigate airflow through part of the vertical farms as well as any skyscraper to allow for more efficient air exchange. And also if you're building like a huge artificial lake on the 15th floor of a building, code issues become an issue, but it'll come.
Okay, we have time for one more.
Well, we have to talk about GMOs, because as evil as you know, the large biotech companies are and squeezing out the natural farmer and blah, 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 they are the future of food in a lot of ways, because right. we can manipulate and the content they're making pigs with omega-3 fatty acids instead of the higher fat and higher toxic fats that are in natural pork. Bananas that have hepatitis B vaccine. So we can use food as a way to proliferate vaccinations in the third world, where needles are an issue and skilled labor are an issue. So GMOs are going to be an interesting option, because we'll have food with fewer intolerances. You're not going to have an issue where you have an allergy to anything, because it's been genetically modified, and peanuts will be genetically modified so that peptide that's eliciting the immune response isn't there anymore. So we get to have peanut butter jam sandwiches back in our elementaries. They're talking about plants that produce plastics. They're trying to get plants that produce egg protein so that they can get an egg flavor out of plants, so that we don't have to use the livestock, which is taxing to the whole environment. So the GMOs are a point of contention for certain people, but if done correctly and in the right hands, any technology can be used for incredible good.
And if anybody in the audience would like to hear more about those the controversies around GMO, please do check our episodes page and just type in GMO. And there's a whole bunch of episodes that we've done on this, so you can find out more information there. So this sounds great. We have bugs, we have algae, we have meat, we have GMOs, but...
Schmeat.
That sounds wrong. It really sounds so gross. So that being said, when are we actually going to see these wonders? Maybe not the GMOs, but the rest of it. Because we're still waiting for hoverboards and jetpacks. And every time I ask someone about a new technology that sounds amazing, I am told that we will see it in the next 10 to 20 years. Everything is within the next 10 to 20 years.
Right. 10 to 20 years, we're going to say the same thing. Well, vertical farms, like I said, are being constructed right now. There's one in Vancouver. It's called Local. And so that's being used, and that's being manipulated in something where we can start to see it. GMOs, 10% of our cropland is already planted with GMOs. So that's a reality that we're facing with different political pressures and different ethical pressures as well. The pressure for the algae is coming, actually, because it's something that's growing in popularity, always been popular in Asia. And as we gain a taste for Asian food, as it's, we see sushi restaurants popping up in every corner, we're going to be eating more and more of it. And there's also a push towards vegetarianism to help with the stress on the livestock. Schmeat. Yeah, I'm going to say 10 to 20 years, Desiree. I think I got to go with that. Sorry about that.
Well, you know what? I do have one more question. Mm-hmm. Because we were promised in the 1950s, and by we, I mean people who are around in the 1950s, were promised that one pill would take care of all their nutritional needs for the day. Where did that go? Are we still trying to do that?
They're still trying to do it. They did it in a prison. Now, I can't remember which prison it was, but it was in the States. They had this like a meatloaf thing that they figured they could save money by serving them just like a meatloaf. It wasn't a pill exactly, but it was pretty darn close to the Soylent Green kind of idea.
Right.
And here, just all your nutrients. And we enjoy food. We enjoy, it's our social surroundings and settings. It's our palate and satiety is all tied into an emotion. And we know a lot of emotional eaters out there. So there's a physiology and a biology that centers around eating. And so a pill, there's been a couple of people who have developed close to pills. But hey, I like flavor. I like taste. I like sitting around my friends. And most people aren't willing to give that up.
Tora, always wonderful to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You can find links to Tora Catcher and her work on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And since you're there, you might like to click the links to the variety of places that we exist on social media, or to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the podcast or listen to past episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell.
Skeptically Speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our guest coordinators are Rochelle Saunders and Ed Haynes. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. Helen Quivillon is our publications coordinator. Ryan Bromsgrove is our production manager and assistant editor. Josh Witten is our researcher. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.
Here on Skeptically Speaking, we work hard to bring you in-depth conversations that explain complex scientific topics without dumbing them down. Usually, we're happy to let the interviews speak for themselves, but every once in a while, we find we need to shake things up a bit. In the next 2 weeks, we'll be making some changes to the show to help us keep bringing science to the people with the genuine awe and enthusiasm you've come to expect. We're excited about what we've got planned, and we think you will be too. So stay tuned, and as always, thanks for listening.